The Case of the Disappearing Lady, Part 4. The London Palladium did not enlighten the atmosphere. Its Romanesque radiation induced a sense of time long gone. A monument to the past, but in this misty weather, this past seemed to come to life. It called for images of gladiators and grotesque power, theaters of blood and death, especially with these ongoing cries of those poor devils. Be it drunken or not, misstepping along the banks of the Thames, and then simply drowning where no hope for salvage or redemption. A group of policemen stood watch in front of the building. Upon questioning the policemen guarding the doors, we found that the royal family in shock inside the Palladium, the public being gone already. In their company was a nervous theatre director, moustache flipping up and down as if he were a large walrus, watery blue-grey eyes as if continuously grieving, but there was no unpleasant harshness about him that I could place. Holmes took one look at the panic-stricken prince and realized not much could be expected from questioning this party. He tried nevertheless, much to my surprise, he did not focus on the circumstances of the fiancée's disappearance. His inquiries instead turned towards her background. What was the lady's age? He asked, upon which the prince replied that she was very secretive about her age, and that he did not know. He believed her to be too vain about it, and therefore did not inquire it too strongly. He was content with the fact that she was very beautiful, looked young, much to his liking. Her birthplace was also somewhat of a mystery, though it was Hungary. The name of her hometown sounded a little bit like Fizz, but he could not be readily pronounced in English. Fizz, Fizz, Fizz. Holmes pronounced the word a couple of times, and then all of a sudden he exclaimed, "Water! That is what it is! The Hungarian word for water!" The prince's father, a sturdy man with no sense of subtlety, looked at Holmes with an expression of sarcasm. "And how is that going to help us, Mr. Holmes? We are here, desperately searching for ways to rescue this young woman, who has been kidnapped for sure, and the police do nothing significant. I am sure we will receive a ransom note asking a substantial amount of money." In a whispering voice, so the Queen Mother, who had tried to comfort her son and was in shock to herself, could not hear it. "And I am sure the woman will turn out to be a fraud, misleading my son purely for his wealth." Holmes looked at the king with an expression of understanding, though I knew this did not imply his agreement, rather the acknowledgement of the king's arrogance for riches. The king, however, mistook Holmes's understanding for sympathy. Holmes turned to the director. He asked. "Mr. Petalis," the director answered. "Ha, peculiar name," Holmes muttered, and then strongly directing his voice towards the man. "Mr. Petalis, can you show me the plans of the fountain you are about to build in front of the theatre?" "Yes, of course," the man replied, hopping his mustache. "Good. Let us go to the building site where the woman was last heard crying. Please," he turned to the royal family, "wait here." The Case of the Disappearing Lady, Part 5. We descended the stairs of the theatre and entered the locality where some recent construction had been done. The marble white blocks of the fountain to be laid bare, naked in the white mist. The place looked like a graveyard as a result. Holmes climbed the stones and started his search in between them, sniffing most of the time as a bloodhound catching a scent. Do you smell this, Watson? He asked me again. I realized that the smell, which I could indeed identify as acetone, was mixed with a smell of ozone. The smell reminded me of the air of a thunderstorm, except it had not stormed. Mr. Patatas grew more and more nervous as Holmes entered the center of the building site. What is this? He asked the director, pointing towards a hole of at least a diameter in the center of the building ground. That is where the fountain will be, Mr. Holmes. Immediately, Holmes demanded a large lantern and a rope. The hole seemed quite deep and steep. I was rather sure at the moment we would find the lady either dead or drowned on the bottom of this pit. The lantern was lowered. There was mud along the inside walls of the pit. When it reached the bottom, I felt my heart beating as we could see some movement. It gave the impression of a swift and rapid jiggling, like a fish on a hook. And surprisingly indeed, it turned out to be a fish. It was wiggling around in just a feet of water. The director started to stammer. But that cannot be. This is a mistake. There is no water in this hole. Never has been. Neither fish. What kind of fish is this? Holmes turned towards the director, trying to calm him. Do not be surprised, my dear man. The fish can easily be thrown in there. As far as I can see, it's a goldfish. Not the type of variety you would find in the Thames. Holmes smiled and the director relaxed, yet when Holmes turned away, he no longer smiled, and I could see his expression. I was shocked by his severe gaze. I'd never seen Holmes like this before. Then, as if he took a final decision, he stood up, straightened his back, and said, "Well, I understand now what happened. Let us return to the heartbroken family." The royal family stood outside the palladium at the bottom of the stairs, shivering from the wet cold. Holmes turned to the king and said, "I fear you are right, sir. You have been misled by this woman. She and her so-called kidnappers were conspiring together to relieve you of your money. The suggestion of water was caused by the fish splashing in the pit. It has been carefully planned. You were taken in by her cries and the sound of running water." Holmes turned to the policeman and requested, "Who's in charge here?" A rather long figure who added with the lamp earlier replied, "Me, sir." Holmes stood, thinking for a moment, and then said, "Please inform Inspector Lestrade of our findings. Ask him to publish these in the newspapers. Upon that, he will probably not hear from this case again. It will be enough that the so-called kidnappers are found out." "Take good care of your son," Holmes shouted after the royal family, taking off his hat as he greeted them and urging me again to jump into the carriages. He was not like Holmes either. The solution, though it satisfied the royal family and probably also the police, would never satisfy Holmes. In anxious anticipation, I waited for Holmes to talk, but he did not do so until we were back in Baker Street, in the intimacy of his rooms. Holmes gave a sigh of moderate relief. "The crime, my dear Watson, is that in our eagerness to create sequences of control over time, we forgot that body experiences are in space and not in time. Only if the individual body has disappeared in time will it commence to tell. I will predict the sequence of events to come. Our Lady in reality is the angel of love and sacrifice, yet no one will ever know." I must say that his prediction came true a couple of weeks later. For the record, he had predicted the following. "Within a week there will be a huge storm, creating a rain shower London has rarely seen. The building site will be completely flooded, but as a result of the event with this disappearing lady, the workers and the police and the general public will be on edges as to the whereabouts of the center pit. They will recognize the danger in time and take precautionary measures as to prevent accidents. The woman has saved the future of her lover, who is the prince, and who, I dare say, might otherwise have drowned. She saved her lover by disappearing.